but he was spotted on July 19 in the three-story building in the densely populated Al-Daraj neighborhood of northern Gaza City, populated mainly by refugees. Intelligence from human sources indicated that the ground floor was made up of empty storerooms, which made it a perfect building on which to drop a bomb. It just had to be done quickly, before Shehada moved again. Deputy Director Yuval Diskin was not eager to go ahead. He demanded that the intelligence desk officers gather more information. Even if the target building was empty, it was surrounded by tin shanties that likely had entire families living in them. He wanted the feasibility of a ground operation, a sniper, for instance, to be gamed out. Performance research, the Air Force Department responsible for forecasting the outcome of attacks, estimated that there would be heavy damage to the shanties. Serious doubts had been raised in IDF discussions as well. The head of the General Staff Operations Directorate recommended waiting 48 hours to clear the tin shacks and make sure there's no one living there. Deputy Chief of Staff Gabriel Gabi Ashkenazi also expressed reservations about executing the operation before more information was known. But the pressure to eliminate the elusive Shehada was too great. A Shin Bet Southern Region commander rejected Diskin's appraisal because his own intelligence report suggested that at night, the tin shanties abutting Shehada's building were not inhabited. He appealed to Shin Bet Chief Dichter, who approved the immediate assassination of Shehada by a bomb from an Air Force fighter. Amman Chief Aharon Ze'evi Farkash supported this decision. If we do not get rid of people like Salah Shehada, more and more Israelis will get hurt, he later said, recounting the decision. In situations like this, Palestinian civilians are liable to get hurt, he added. When you have to decide between two children, I prefer that the Jewish Israeli child won't weep. The pilot climbed into his F-16 fighter, sitting on the tarmac at Hatzor, the Air Force base in south-central Israel. His plane was armed with a one-ton bomb. Two half-ton bombs would have limited the damage and contained the blast area, but it was impossible to know exactly where in the house Shehada would be. There was no point in destroying just the second floor if he was sleeping near the door to the street. A bigger bomb would make sure he was dead. The operation had been canceled three times already, first because the 19th was a Friday and the Muslim day of rest, when the streets would be crowded, and again on the next two nights, the 20th and 21st, because Shehada's daughter was believed to be with him. On the evening of July 22, however, the team was divided. Although everyone agreed that Shehada's wife was at the apartment, and that the orders permitted them to continue on with the operation anyway, only some of the team believed that the intelligence indicated that the daughter was not at home. Yuval Diskin, who was directly in charge of the targeted killing operation, was not entirely convinced by the estimation that there was a low likelihood of Iman being in the apartment. Diskin phoned Dichter and told him about his doubts, and recommended calling off the attack, but, according to an official inquiry, the director of the Shin Bet weighed all of the data and estimations and reached the conclusion that there was a very high probability that Iman was not in the house, and accordingly he ordered that the operation be executed. Dichter phoned Prime Minister Sharon's military secretary. He woke Sharon, who authorized immediate execution of the bombing raid. The pilot started to close the canopy. His base commander came running up to his plane and climbed the ladder to his cockpit. "Do you want to know who it is?" he asked the pilot and the navigator. Who they were going to kill, he meant. "Get off my plane," the pilot said. "We don't want to know. It means nothing." In a way, it didn't. The men who did the actual killing, who flew the missions and released the bombs, often knew the least. At altitude, all they could see were small targets identified by the 12 numbers of the coordinates, and there was no need to look for anything more. A siren sounded, and the F-16 was cleared for takeoff. It was 11 o'clock on the night of July 22. Flying time from Hatzor to Gaza was 2 minutes, but the pilot was ordered to fly west, over the sea, far out into the dark. Shahade, he smells planes, hears planes, and he runs away, the pilot said later. We wait over the sea for 50 minutes. Then my flight controller tells me on the radio, engage. The plane streaked eastward, turned back to the west, and dropped the bomb. You must have seen it in the movies, the pilot said. That's what it looks like. We hit it, and the house collapses, falls down. In the days before the F-16 took off, Air Force intelligence had carried out a number of reconnaissance missions over the house where Shahada was hiding. Analysts studied aerial photographs and saw solar heaters, laundry hung out to dry, and satellite dishes bolted to shacks. People lived there. The Shin Bet case officer thought so too. Because the entire area was densely populated, he noted, he presumed that the shacks were too. But the Shin Bet did not get positive intelligence from any source indicating with certainty that the shacks were inhabited. In other words, none of the sources walked in and explicitly said that shack was occupied by this family. As the operational plans grew more detailed and the time for execution approached, common sense was overwhelmed by excitement over the opportunity to eliminate a man involved in the murders of almost 500 people, including 30 who were killed after two other assassination missions had been scrapped. At some point, according to Shin Bet personnel involved, no positive intelligence became no civilians live there. The location of Shahada created a window of opportunity that was unlikely to be repeated at all or in the near future, an inquiry later concluded. He constituted a ticking time bomb that had to be neutralized. The result was catastrophic. Shahada was killed outright, as was his assistant Nacher Nassar and his wife. But so were his daughter Iman and 10 other civilians, including 7 children, the youngest less than 1 year old. 150 people were wounded. Haaretz journalist Gideon Levy, whose reports and columns reflect the concerns of liberal Israelis over the plight of the Palestinians, arrived at the scene a few hours after the disaster. He recalled, "They said they thought there were uninhabited shacks there. Those were 2- and 3-story buildings. There's no such building in Gaza that isn't inhabited. The people who were out to eliminate Shahada knew this. I am not naive or a bleeding heart. If I could rely on the establishment having restraints, I would certainly have been in favor of killing a man like Salah Shahada, as long as he was alone and it was possible to ensure that no one else would be hurt. But I know that it is impossible to rely on them to restrain themselves. There is no control, neither internal nor public, and ultimately they do whatever they wish. The cost-benefit of assassinations is awful. Awful. This case is ample proof. Entire families were wiped out. In the hospital, I saw a little boy about to die, his whole body full of shrapnel. Awful." Avi Dichter immediately grasped the consequences. "The target has been eliminated," he said, "but the operation failed." Curiously, there was little international condemnation of the attack, but in Israel, there was a storm of protest. The media, which generally repeated the statements put out by the IDF spokesperson and the Shin Bet, was harshly critical, amplifying anonymous leaks of mutual recrimination among those involved in the operation. More and more voices were heard in Israel questioning the wisdom of assassination as a weapon. The commander of the Air Force, Major General Dan Halutz, who had not been directly involved in the operation because he was traveling abroad, was furious at the media and wanted to support his subordinates. He gave an interview to Haaretz in which he roundly condemned the critics, saying that some of them should be prosecuted for harming state security. Halutz stressed that he fully backed his pilots and completely condoned the elimination of Shahada, although he did express sorrow over the loss of life among uninvolved persons. He recounted that a short time after the operation, he met with the airmen involved in the bombing. "Guys, you can sleep well at night," he told them. You did exactly what you were instructed to do. You did not deviate a millimeter to the left or the right. Let all those who have a problem with it come to me." Halutz, a former pilot himself, added, "If you nevertheless want to know what I feel when I release a bomb, then I'll tell you. I feel a slight shudder in the wing as a result of the release of the bomb. After a second it passes, and that's all. That's what I feel." The interview, and particularly the phrase, "a slight shudder in the wing," which has since become shorthand in Israel for indifference to the lives of innocents, only flared tempers further. Even other airmen were appalled. The pilot who dropped the bomb wasn't initially concerned with whom it was that he hit. "That's nice," he said when his commander told him it was Shehadeh, "but whether it was a good hit." But a few days after that, he said, three guys came to the squadron, three reservists. They said, "What have you done? You went, you killed, you murdered." A rebellion was rising among reservist pilots, who after their discharge do a day's duty every week in peacetime and full-scale service in wartime. They were generally older, had lived as civilians, and saw the world more from a perspective of democratic governance than military dominance. Groups of them, airmen and Sayeret Matkal reservists, published separately letters in the media announcing their refusal to take part in aggressive actions against Palestinians, primarily targeted killings. The protesting airmen and soldiers knew they would pay a high price for signing the open letters. In a tense public atmosphere created by the bloodshed of the suicide terrorists, these statements were perceived by many Israelis as no less than treason, and by some of the top IDF officials as a refusal to carry out orders in wartime. Particularly striking was the signature of former Brigadier General Yiftach Spector, a pilot with a world record of 12 enemy supersonic fighters shot down, who was considered by many to be the best combat pilot in the history of the Israeli Air Force. Another signatory was Lieutenant Colonel Yoel Petterberg, a renowned helicopter pilot who had been decorated for extreme bravery in rescuing a ground force pinned down by an ambush in Lebanon. "Shalom, my name is Yoel," he said in a speech at a protest rally. "I have been the pilot of Cobra, Apache, and Black Hawk helicopters in the Israel Defense Forces, and today I am refusing to serve in the Israel Occupation Forces. We are the soldiers of peace. We shall stop the war, the death, and the grieving. You are the leaders of the state, leaders of the army, and you will face the consequences. If not in Israeli courts, then in the court at The Hague, and if not in The Hague, than before your maker." Before the Intifada, targeted killings had been primarily the secret business of small, compartmentalized teams working for the Mossad, far from the borders of the country. They might have been carried out in the national interest, but any moral reckoning was confined to a handful of operatives and government ministers. Once those intimate operations were developed into a large-scale killing machine, however, thousands of people became complicit. IDF soldiers and airmen, Shin Bet personnel, the people who collected and filtered and analyzed and disseminated intelligence, they were all directly involved, often in more important ways than those who did the actual killing. And by the summer of 2002, no Israeli could claim ignorance of what was being done in his name. The protests were greeted mostly by angry rebuttals. Ehud Yatom, the former Shin Bet operative who had killed the two Bus 300 prisoners, was at the time a politician in Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party and was to become a Knesset member in 2003. "Those who refused to serve were defeatists," he said. "They must be condemned, prosecuted, stripped of their unit's insignia, and thrown out of the army." The IDF announced that it would indeed oust those who did not withdraw their signatures from the protest letters. 3 days after the pilot's letter was published, Ariel Sharon's closest advisors gathered at his sycamore farm, Havat Shikmim, in southern Israel. One of them called the letter "The Wailing of Defeatists." Sharon raised his voice at him. "You are wrong," he snapped. "These are not those beatniks who report to the induction center with the earrings and the green curl." there are people on this list who have done the most daring of deeds for Israel. Sharon looked at his advisors. He understood how dire the situation had become. "A fire," he said, "has taken hold among the cedars." Chapter 31. The Rebellion in Unit 8200. When a person dies, the joke goes, he ascends to heaven to stand before God, seated on his divine throne. God asks each of the newly dead whether he should remain in heaven or be cast into hell. Each one answers, God passes his judgment, and then the next steps forward. In the joke, the last person is always a network intelligence officer. Within the larger military and intelligence communities, NIOs are the ones who pick which bits of intel among the massive flood arriving every day are worth pursuing. They decide what is important and what is not. They decide, in a way, which people will stand in line before God's throne. The NIO steps forward. "And where should you go?" God asks. "Nowhere," the NIO says, slightly annoyed. "You're sitting in my chair." Amir, not his real name, was an NIO, a bright young man assigned to Unit 8200, one of the most prestigious outfits in the IDF. He worked, like all NIOs, at a base protected by reinforced concrete, monitoring information. Most of the incoming material couldn't be translated and processed because there was simply too much of it and too little time. The NIO's job, then, was to decide which channels of communication should be listened to and which broadcasts should be intercepted. Soldiers like Amir decided which bits of the intelligence sieved by his subordinates would be translated and disseminated. He was the final editor of The Article, as intelligence messages are called in 8200. He wrote the headline and decided who would read it. He had to decide, for example, whether the speaker in an intercepted conversation was a storekeeper ordering merchandise or a jihadist delivering coded instructions to prepare a bomb. If he made a mistake, innocent people, Israelis on one side, a hapless shop owner on the other, could die. And he needed to do all of this very quickly. Officially, Amir and his colleagues at Unit 8200's Turban Base were responsible for stopping terror attacks. Unofficially, they were deciding whom Israel killed. True, it was Sharon who authorized the targeted killings, and there was a long chain of command between them and the Prime Minister's office. But the politicians merely approved the intelligence community's recommendations, which were ultimately conceived, to a large extent, by the NIO. "Our role in the selection of targets for assassination was dramatic," one NIO said. "I could decide if, in my estimation, someone was the coordinator of a cell, to sit on him firmly, and to collect enough info to zero in on him as a target for elimination. If the man actually was involved in terror, it was a process that would take a few weeks, no more." Often, Unit 8200 also picked out buildings to bomb. Sharon, along with IDF Chief of Staff Moshe Ya'alon, held the Palestinian Authority fully responsible for every attack, even if the actual perpetrators came from organizations, Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that opposed the authority. As a result, Israel took punitive measures against the Palestinian Authority after each attack, bombing its facilities. Most of these facilities were offices of the civilian government, and the same ones were often bombed repeatedly, even after they had been destroyed and abandoned. The bombings were a way to send a message to the Palestinians, but also simply a way for Israel's leaders and soldiers to express their frustration and anger. The targets for reprisal bombardments were not chosen in order to achieve a concrete military goal, Amir said, but were rather a political message that could be summed up simply as, "We'll show them." At first, Israel would notify the Palestinian leadership that the Air Force was setting out to destroy a particular building in order to give the people inside time to evacuate. But over time, this practice eroded to a certain extent, and later, toward the end of 2002, the Air Force often bombed at night, without advance warning, on the assumption that the buildings were empty at that time. It was, for the most part, a purely symbolic campaign. On January 5, 2003, two suicide bombers from Fatah's al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades slipped into Tel Aviv and made their way toward the old central bus station. At 6:26 p.m., they blew themselves up near downtown Tel Aviv. The final death count was 23, with more than 100 wounded. Many were babies or children. The Palestinian Authority condemned the attack and promised to make every effort to apprehend the men who had planned it. The Israelis were not convinced of the sincerity of this condemnation, however. After all, the bombers came from an organization affiliated with Fatah, which was under Arafat's command. Most of the top members of the Palestinian Authority were Fatah people. Prime Minister Sharon immediately summoned the defense leadership for a consultation in his office, and they decided to step up action against the Palestinian Authority. Following that meeting, less than 3 hours after the attack, Chief of Staff Ya'alon decided to bomb target 7068, the code name for the Fatah branch office in the Gaza Strip city of Khan Yunis. This time there would be no warning, and the attack would not come at night. The IDF would instead wait deliberately and patiently until there were people in the building. At 11:45 p.m., the targets department, Anaf Matarot, at Amman headquarters, submitted a request to the 8200 Turban base to collect information on the Fatah building in Khan Yunis. At 12:31 a.m., Turban sent out its report on the chosen target. According to the report, target 7068 had no connection to terror activities. The sergeant who conducted the investigation of the site wrote simply and directly, "Don't bomb them. They haven't done anything bad." "It was a very informal way of putting it," Amir said, "and of course I had to change the wording to something more businesslike before sending out the cable." But his heading reflected the content of the report very well. No activity connected to terror took place there, just routine office work regarding local political activists, paying out welfare and salaries. It was the Gaza Strip equivalent of a labor union local. Early the next morning, Amir, who assumed target 7068 would be just another symbolic strike, told Amman headquarters that no one was in the building and that it was safe to start the bombardment. "It's on hold," he was told by a representative of Amman's targets department. "They're waiting for the office to open." "What? Who are they expecting?" "No one. It's not a particular person, just anyone. Let us know when someone goes inside." That seemed strange. Amir thought it had to be a misunderstanding. The presence of civilians in a building was a reason to stand down, not to strike. Waiting for people, bureaucrats, cleaners, secretaries, went flatly against Finkelstein's 2001 legal memo. Targeting civilians, in fact, was an outright war crime. But there was no misunderstanding. The targets department issued a written order so that everyone understood that they were waiting for an indication that the building was occupied. Indication equals an attempt to make a phone call or a phone conversation. Do not wait for the speaker to identify himself or for a conversation of any value to take place. Every indication of the habitation of the building is to be reported, without connection to who the speaker is or the content of the conversation. In other words, the intention was simply to kill someone. Anyone. The order bothered some of the NIOs, who dared speak of it only in the mess hall. "We sat there, three NIOs eating supper," Amir recalled, "and someone said, half in jest but actually serious, 'Say, isn't this precisely the definition of a manifestly illegal order?'" He said it offhandedly, not in any heavy way, but it made us start thinking. Maybe we were really crossing a red line here? Maybe this was something improper? How would we know who we were killing? Maybe it would be a kid from a nearby school who went in to make a phone call. Maybe it would be a clerk who came to hand out UN aid money, or an office cleaner who came in early, before work hours. The fact that such a conversation would take place among members of Unit 8200 was fitting. This, after all, was the unit that had tried its hardest to warn Amman in the days preceding the surprise attacks on Israel in October 1973, cautioning that Egypt and Syria were bent on going to war. In the wake of that failure, we intentionally chose opinionated people for the position of NIO, who think out of the box and who would not be afraid to say what they thought, said Professor Eyal Zisser, a prominent Tel Aviv University Middle East specialist who did his IDF reserves service as head of the NIO selection committee. Because of their access to highly classified material at such a young age, the Army tried to inculcate the NIOs with a sense of moral and legal responsibility during their lengthy training. One of their lessons, for example, dealt with civil rights and the violation of those rights that sometimes occurs as a result of wiretaps. The trainees were told that they must not exploit the immense power they were given for any purpose other than obtaining information for the benefit of the security of the state. The case study that was used outlined an incident in 1997 in which some men from Unit 8200, attempting to locate calls concerning Osama bin Laden, accidentally picked up, then purposely recorded, some cell phone conversations between Tom Cruise, who was working in the Middle East at the time, and his then-wife, Nicole Kidman. They then distributed the recordings to their pals and read the transcripts out loud. And if that eavesdropping was perceived as a forbidden and immoral act, said Amir, then it's clear that bombing that building should be forbidden. The more I thought of it, the more I realized that it was forbidden to carry out such an order. Amir raised the matter with the senior NIO and with the command of 8200. The command said they understood there was a problem, and the operation was put on hold until further notice. That satisfied me, and I could go back to my post, which I had closed down, at about 2 a.m., with the sense that the story was behind us. However, the next morning, when he sat down at the NIO's workstation and began directing the shift, he got a call from the targets department notifying him that the bombing of the Fatah branch in Khan Yunis was about to get underway. Amir objected, but the officer on the other side of the scrambled line got angry. Why does it seem manifestly illegal to you? They're all Arabs. They're all terrorists. In my unit, Amir told him, we make a very clear distinction between terrorists and those who are not involved, such as people who routinely used the target building. But he wasn't changing anyone's mind, and by then the operation was already in motion. Two armed F-16 fighter jets were circling over the Mediterranean, waiting for the order. A drone was photographing the building from a distance. As soon as Amir told them someone was in the building, two Hellfire missiles would be launched at the structure. Amir decided he would refuse to cooperate. The fire in the cedars was spreading. Impatient calls started coming into 8200 command from the Air Force and Amman. They were saying, listen, your unit is refusing to give us such and such information. Brigadier General Yair Cohen, commander of Unit 8200 at the time, recalled. I said that they must be mistaken, that there was no such thing in 8200 as not providing information, that it had never happened and never would happen. At 10:05, Amir got a call from 8200 command. Yair Cohen says this is no time to ask questions, he was told, but a time to act. The operational order required the bombardment to be completed by 11:30, when children would be emptying into a nearby schoolyard. This is a manifestly illegal order, and I do not intend to obey it, Amir said. The fact that the commander has declared it to be legal doesn't make it legal. There was a pause on the line. I have conveyed the message from the commander as it was issued, Amir was told. I'm happy not to be in your position at this moment. A few minutes later, one of Amir's soldiers told him that phone calls were being made inside the Fatah building. A man was dealing with wage payments, trying to get money to some employees, despite the hard times in the Palestinian Authority and the ongoing war. A secretary was gossiping about a local gigolo. That was the go signal. The F-16 could fire. Israel could kill them both. Amir sat in his chair as the on-duty NIO. "A certain serenity came over me," he said. "I felt that there was only one right thing to do. It was clear to me that this operation should not go forward, that it crossed a red line, that it was a manifestly illegal order over which a black flag flew, and that it was my responsibility, as a soldier and a human being, to refuse to carry it out." He ordered the information not be passed on. He ordered all activity stopped. At 10:50, just 40 minutes before the operation's time window closed, Amir's direct commander, Y, arrived at the base, relieved Amir of his post, and took the NIO seat for himself. He ordered one of the soldiers to report that people were in the building. The bombing could go ahead. But it was already too late. The planes had returned to base at the Tel Nof airfield. Now the information was passed on to them and they took off again, but by the time they homed in on the target, the clock showed 11:25, and the school bell rang. That evening, the 8200 command sent an urgent message to the head of Amman, expressing grave reservations about the operation. It was transmitted to the Minister of Defense, who ordered the cancellation of the attack on Target 7068. This was a clear vindication of Amir's moral stand, but it was too late to silence the storm that the mutiny in 8200 had unleashed in the military. Unit 8200's command came under heavy fire from all sides of the defense establishment. Even Prime Minister Sharon let it be known that he took a very dim view of what had transpired. Brigadier General Cohen was summoned to an IDF general staff meeting devoted entirely to Amir. He should face a court-martial, the officers argued, and go to jail for at least 6 months. One general went further. That officer should have been convicted of treason and put in front of a firing squad. The protests by airmen after the Shehada bombing a few months earlier, and the refusal of Seiret Matkal personnel to take part in targeted killing operations, was still fresh in everyone's mind. Someone, possibly from one of 8200's rival units, leaked the story to the media. There were no details in the report, but given the already tense public atmosphere, it was enough to get demonstrators from the left and from the right out onto the streets. Although it was only a few days before the Knesset elections, many of the headlines were about the refusers. The military and intelligence establishments were concerned that Amir could be the first of many soldiers to refuse to carry out orders. From the commander's perspective, putting down a Palestinian uprising didn't leave a lot of room for squishy liberal objectors. Unit 8200 is the epitome of the culture of secrecy, always far out of sight, always alone, isolated from the rest of the army, high quality, and covert, a man who served in a senior position at the time said. All of a sudden, it found itself under a spotlight inside the IDF, and in the most negative possible context. Everyone always says that the 8200's soldiers are pampered kids from the best part of Tel Aviv, who go to the army and get the best training in the world, and then cash in their skills for billions in high-tech startups, and that they must all be left-wingers and homos. The unit is constantly trying to fight that image, and suddenly it gets labeled as being full of anarchists who refuse to carry out orders. Amir's contention that what amounted to an order to murder civilians was manifestly illegal was rejected out of hand by the military. For one thing, only someone actually pressing the trigger and not anyone else involved in the operation could refuse out of a belief that such a kill order was illegal, declared Major General Eleazar Stern, the head of the IDF's Human Resources Directorate. Professor Asa Kasher, a philosopher, was invited by the commander of 8200 to discuss the issue. He believed that Amir's actions were morally incorrect. "I could not under any circumstances endorse the act of the NIO," he said. In the situation that prevailed there, when he was an NIO at a distant base, he lacked the moral authority to determine that the order was manifestly illegal. He did not know the entire story. He did not see the entire picture, and he did not know about the broader tactics that the chief of staff had decided on. I'm in favor of asking questions and raising doubts, but an order should not be refused at such moments." Amir was quietly discharged without being indicted, preventing the courts from having an opportunity to determine whether the order to murder civilians in Target 7068 had been legal. The operation on Target 7068 had violated the guidelines set by the IDF Military Advocate General's International Law Department, that the target for elimination must be an individual directly linked to terrorism. But that wasn't the only guideline that was now breached all too regularly, part of a general decline in the prevailing moral and legal standards. There was also a guideline that called for an investigation each time innocent civilians were killed along with the target. In fact, this protocol was almost never followed. The inquiry into the Shahada killings, which ultimately came to the conclusion that no one was to blame for the deaths of 12 civilians, was the exception, and it too was set up only after heavy public and international pressure on Israel. Another guideline now frequently breached dictated that there should be no killings when there was a reasonable arrest alternative, when the terrorist could be detained without endangering the lives of soldiers or civilians. Alon Castile, a soldier in the Cherry Unit's intelligence section, said, "Everything about my military service changed after the outbreak of the Intifada. Before that, we made very great efforts to capture wanted men alive. After the outbreak, this modus operandi ended. It was clear that we were out to kill." Operational orders from that period indicate that the expectation was that the wanted man would be killed the moment he was identified. In Operation Two Towers, for example, the operational order contradicts itself. One, the objective is arrest. Two, if the framing, positive identification, is of a senior PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad figure, Walid Obeid Ziad Malaysia Adham Yunus, the force is authorized to execute interception. The term interception is a euphemism for elimination or killing, and it came to be used frequently as a way to sidestep the ILD's guidelines. The operation unfolded accordingly. Malaysia was framed and intercepted, shot dead. Yet another violation of the ILD's protocol regularly occurred as a result of the provision that only the Prime Minister had the authority to approve targeted killing ops. Amman officials resented the fact that Sharon had given the Shin Bet overall authority on assassinations. In order to bypass the IDL guidelines, Amman set up an identical parallel apparatus to carry out, without needing Sharon's approval, what it called interception operations against anyone linked to acquiring, developing, stockpiling, transporting, or using weapons on behalf of terrorist organizations. "Orders barred me from carrying out assassinations, but no one forbade us to shoot at anyone launching Qassams or transporting explosives," said a senior Amman officer. On some occasions, a shipment of weapons or a Qassam launching squad was in fact identified in real time, so the killing was indeed justifiable. But often, interception was simply another word for a pre-planned assassination, because Amman wanted a certain person dead. "We called it interception, but of course it was assassination," said an Amman official. "We ran one operation after another without stopping. Some of these were legitimate military actions. Some were assassinations of key terrorists, and many were in a gray area between the two." Over time, the military and intelligence communities got better and better at inventing novel ways of gaming the official protocols. The IDF had greatly broadened the open-fire procedures, such that in terrorist-infested areas, soldiers were instructed to shoot at anyone holding any kind of firearm, Molotov cocktail, or explosive device, without any warning, and then confirm the kill. In order to create situations in which armed, suspected terrorists would emerge from their hiding places and into the streets and alleys, where they would be exposed to Israeli gunfire, an operational procedure codenamed Grass Widow was developed. During the course of the conflict in the occupied territories, several variations of the Grass Widow technique were used, baiting gunmen out of their hiding places and exposing them to fire from a concealed sniping position. In one variation, an Israeli force would arrest a comrade of the terrorist out in the open on the street, prompting armed gunmen to come outside and attack the force. In another, an armored car would drive up and down a street, with a loudspeaker broadcasting an Arabic recording of shouted challenges like, "So where are all the big heroes of Izz al-Din al-Qassam? Why don't you come out and fight? Let's see if you are men." Or, more provocatively, "All the jihad are fags." Or, "Hamas are sons of whores. Your mothers work in the streets and give it out free to anyone who wants it." These are some of the more refined remarks. Others are even less suitable for print. Perhaps surprisingly, this method has worked well. Gunmen come out to shoot at the offending vehicle and end up getting picked off by a sniper from Grass Widow concealed in a nearby apartment. Grass Widow operations killed dozens of gunmen from all the Palestinian organizations. From the military's point of view, the system worked, and the IDF gained relative freedom of action in the streets of Palestinian cities. The legality of these operations, however, is debatable at best. By the summer of 2002, the Shin Bet and its partners were able to stop more than 80% of attacks before they turned deadly. The targeted killings were clearly saving lives. But there was a disturbing trend in the data, too. The number of attempted attacks was increasing. Rather than being worn down, the Palestinians were spawning more and more attackers. That meant that Israel had to focus on more targets. But it also raised a fear that, over time, the terrorist groups would learn from each individual defeat and would adapt and get smarter and tougher, leading to a potentially endless escalation in a potentially endless war. We felt we had something like a year, perhaps a little more, to give them such a punch that would make the whole business not worth it, from their point of view, said a senior Shin Bet official from that period. That concern led to a new plan, codenamed Picking Anemones. Although Israel already had declared every member of those organizations part of the ticking infrastructure, it had almost never touched the political leaders. But that reasoning had evolved. In Hamas, there was no distinction between the political and military echelons, said Amman Chief Major General Ze'evi Farkash. The leaders who are called political are involved in everything. They lay down the policy and issue orders about when to carry out attacks and when to hold back. Indeed, the argument went, the only point of declaring a political wing was to fabricate international status and give certain leaders immunity from assassination. We had to build a clear-cut deterrent, Ze'evi Farkash said. There's no such thing as a political echelon, which we will not touch. Every leader of Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad was now a target. The plan was to kill them all. Chapter 32. Picking Anemones. Ibrahim al-Makadmeh knew the Israelis were going to kill him. He should have, anyway, considering that the Palestinian authorities' intelligence agencies told him as much. They'd heard it from a Shin Bet double agent, who said he'd been asked by the Israelis to monitor Makadmeh's routines. Why else would the Shin Bet want to know his comings and goings, if not to kill him? Maybe he didn't believe it. Makadmeh had published some books and articles on religion, jihad, and Jewish immigration to Palestine, and he was an Islamic theorist. An extreme Hamas strategist, he advocated a holy war to destroy the Jewish state, and he served as a liaison between the organization's political and military wings. But he was also a dentist and a popular lecturer at the Islamic University of Gaza. He was a learned man of academia who spent most of his time immersed in politics rather than direct involvement in terror operations. The PA operatives told him to lie low for a while and to wait until the Israelis got tired of looking for him. Makadmeh ignored them and continued lecturing at the university as usual. His assistant and two bodyguards picked him up at his home in the Gaza neighborhood of Sheikh Radwan at about 9:30 on the morning of March 8, 2003. An Israeli drone watched. The assistant called the dean's office at the university to let him know Makadmeh would be there shortly, and that he expected students to be waiting in the lecture hall. Despite the risk to his life, the assistant added, a dramatic flourish he probably didn't really believe. Makadmeh, the assistant, and the bodyguards made it 1,000 feet down Al-Jala Street before 4 Hellfire missiles fired from 2 Apache helicopters destroyed the car. They, along with a little child who was playing in the street nearby, were the first casualties of Operation Picking Anemones, approved by Sharon and his security cabinet in early 2003. The basic assumption was that what the leaders of the jihadist terror organizations wanted their followers to do, suicide attacks, would take on a different dimension when a price tag was attached, namely their own lives. Or, as Amos Gilad, head of the Defense Ministry's political security staff, described it, they all know that the 72 virgins in paradise is an option that cannot be proved, and they, the leaders, are simply not prepared to check it out for themselves. Operation Picking Anemones was more nuanced than the wholesale assassination campaign against political leaders that Amman Chief General Ze'evi Farkash had advocated. The operation would not, in fact, go after all Hamas and PIJ leaders. Sheikh Yassin, the founder of Hamas, for instance, was left off the initial list of targets, for fear that more Palestinians would join the fighting if he were killed. But the point was the same. To let Hamas and the PIJ know that calling yourself a political functionary was no longer cover. Defining the parameters had taken months of debate, as had agreeing on whether such killings were legal, moral, and most important, strategically practical. Drawing analogies between terrorism and a snake, which will stop functioning if you cut off its head, is such an oversimplification that it's alarming to think anyone believes it, argued Ami Ayalon, Avi Dikter's predecessor as Shin Bet director. A terror organization is built like a matrix. Even if it does have a head, then it is an ideological head that hardly controls the operative head. In other words, there wasn't much of an operational point, but it did create a parallel precedent. If the political leaders of Hamas were legitimate targets, he said, what about the Israeli defense minister who sits in his office and authorizes actions? Does this make him a legitimate target for elimination? Nonetheless, Operation Picking Anemones was eased into practice. 3 months after Makadmeh was hit, an IDF drone fired at Abd al-Aziz Rantisi, the number 2 man in Hamas, but only wounded him. Then on August 12, Ismail Abu Shanab, a founder of Hamas, the leader of its political arm and one of its main spokesmen in the Arabic and foreign media, was killed near the UN building in Gaza by 5 missiles fired from an Apache. As senior foreign ministry officials had feared prior to embarking on Operation Picking Anemones, the international community did indeed make a distinction between attacking military operatives and political operatives. The Abu Shanab assassination sharpened the international debate about Israel's actions, despite the West's recognition that Israel was waging a tough battle against suicide bombers. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan condemned the hit, declaring that Israel had no right to carry out an extrajudicial killing of a senior Hamas leader. The late Abu Shanab's boss, Sheikh Yassin, stated his intentions in starker terms. All of the red lines have been crossed, he said in a statement to the Palestinian media, and Israel will pay for it. Exactly how Israel would pay for its latest escalation was unclear, perhaps even to Yassin. The old rules were bloody and savage, but at least they marked some semblance of a tactical boundary. The killing of Abu Shanab, someone who had been involved in the political part of Hamas and was seen by leaders of the organization as off-limits, deeply rattled Hamas. Yassin needed to figure out a response, and quickly. Shortly after that assassination, Yassin ordered all of Hamas's military and political leadership to gather on September 6 at the home of Dr. Marwan Abu Ras, a leading religious figure in Gaza and a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. That was an extraordinary risk. Putting all of his senior men in one spot at one time created an enormous target. If the secret got out, Yassin's only hope would be that Israel might decide that killing everyone wouldn't be worth the potential collateral damage. Avi Dichter, the Shin Bet director who had learned of the meeting from both human and technological sources, thought it might be a fair trade. "In my entire career," he said, "never did such a serious adversary make such a serious mistake. A profound strategic mistake." The meeting was supposed to begin at 4 o'clock. By 3:40 p.m., a pair of F-16s armed with one-ton bombs were in the air, circling above the Mediterranean Sea, in order to avoid stirring suspicion among those gathered in the home. The Air Force Analysis Wing had calculated that a bomb that big was needed to destroy Abu Ras's three-story house. At 3:45, Chief of Staff Ya'alon called in the operations analysts with maps and aerial photographs. "What's your estimate for collateral damage?" Ya'alon asked. There was a five-story apartment building close to the Abu Ras house. Nearly 40 families lived there. "The men may not be home from work at 4 p.m., Amman Chief Ze'evi Farkash said, "but it's clear that there must be dozens of women and children there." "And what will happen to them if we use the one-ton bomb?" "Dozens of casualties. Possibly even more than that," another analyst answered. The protests that followed the Shahada fiasco hadn't been forgotten. "There wasn't anyone among us who was obsessed with killing," said Dov Weissglass, Sharon's aide. "On the contrary, in time the Air Force realized that the damage that 7 or 8 civilian deaths caused was far greater than the benefits of eliminating one terrorist. The Air Force had even worked to develop munitions with a smaller blast radius, replacing up to 90% of the explosive material with cement. But a cement bomb wasn't going to take out a three-story building." Ya'alon joined a conference call with Sharon, Dichter, and three others. "Mr. Prime Minister," he said, "I recommend calling off the strike. The price of the operation will be dozens of civilians killed. We'll win the battle but lose the war, in both the international and domestic arenas. The people of Israel will not tolerate another blow like this against women and children. We need internal and external legitimacy to carry on with our fight. And here we're liable to deal both a devastating blow." Dichter argued that Israel would be missing a historic opportunity to cause perhaps irreparable damage to its principal enemy. But Ya'alon insisted. "Under no circumstances can we do this," he said. "We could wipe out the Hamas leadership, but we're also at risk of getting hundreds of thousands of protesters in Rabin Square, yelling that we are a brutal army that murders women and children. This we need to avoid. We'll get our chance. Their day will come." Sharon called off the strike. Dichter stayed behind in the joint war room, fuming and frustrated. Ironically, he'd been among the first to recognize what a disaster the Shahada fiasco had been, to realize that killing and wounding scores of civilians meant that the target has been eliminated, but the operation failed. But the Hamas gathering was historic. The Dream Team gathering, he called it. He scrolled through all the intelligence information about the Hamas conclave and, after a few minutes, hit upon a solution. The Diwan, the carpeted sitting room where meetings would be held, was on the top floor, where the drapes had been drawn. It was reasonable to assume the meeting would be held there, and he got an analyst in the JWR to say as much. Dichter called up operations analysts and asked if there was a way to destroy only that part of the house, ensuring that there would be no damage to adjoining structures. The reply was affirmative. If a small missile with a quarter-ton warhead was fired through a window, it would assure the destruction of everyone in the room while doing little or no damage outside of it. Dichter got everyone back on the phone and told them the meeting would probably take place on the third floor. Ze'evi Farkash was doubtful. Ya'alon was not convinced either. It seemed a little strange to me that they would carry Yassin up in his wheelchair, he said. But that was the Shin Bet's assessment. A top floor I know how to wreck without causing casualties in the adjoining houses. It was possible to proceed. Again, there was a conference call with all of the top officials on the secure phone line. Sharon listened until Dichter and Ya'alon finished speaking and approved the operation. The JWR put three drones into the air to keep an eye on the house. They watched the participants arriving and entering. The Shin Bet's information proved to be precise. The entire political and military leadership of Hamas was there, including Yassin in his wheelchair, Ahmed Jabari, who had replaced Shehadeh as field commander, and Mohammed Dif, commander of the Izz al-Din al-Qassam brigades. The Israelis had been trying to kill Dif for more than 7 years, ever since he replaced Yahya Ayash in early 1996. Each time, we took off an arm or a leg of his, but he survived it all, says a senior Shin Bet official who was present in the JWR that day. At 4:35, an F-16 pilot launched a missile through the draped window on the third floor. Alpha, reported the pilot, indicating a direct bullseye hit. The top of the building erupted in flames, and debris, including bricks and furniture, flew in all directions. JWR analysts tried to see whether the debris also included body parts. An enormous explosion shook the entire area. But the meeting had been on the ground floor. They just got up, brushed off the dust, and ran away from the house, Dichter said. We watched them running for their lives. For a moment, I even thought I saw Sheikh Yassin getting up on his feet from the wheelchair, out of panic, and starting to run. Dichter wanted to send in a squadron of drones to blast all of the cars screeching out of the house's parking space, but he was overruled by Defense Minister Mofaz because civilians were likely to be hurt. I looked around the war room, said Dichter. And I saw how everyone was going out of their mind at the missed chance. This was a classic example of the price you have to pay because of the problems that a story like the Shehadeh hit creates. I wouldn't dare to count up the number of Israelis who were killed and wounded due to the decision not to blast the whole house. Later on, we had to handle them one at a time. In some cases, we succeeded after great efforts. Some of them, I'm sorry to say, are alive to this day. 3 days after the strike on Abu Raz's house, just before 6 o'clock, a man wearing an army uniform and carrying a large backpack joined a group of hundreds of IDF soldiers waiting outside the Tzrifin army base in the late afternoon heat. The bus stop and hitchhiking post had a high roof to provide shade from the blistering sun, and the men waited there for a bus or a lift from someone happy to offer a ride to the soldiers, hurrying to begin their brief furloughs. A few minutes later, an IDF patrol approached the stop. The man, a Hamas suicide bomber, apparently feared that he would be detected, and pressed the button. 9 soldiers were killed, and 18 were wounded. Hamas was flailing, lashing back at Israel for the strike on Abu Raz's house and the assassinations of its political figures. To retaliate, Hamas had returned to the same low-tech, high-terror tactics that had led to Israel's escalation in the first place. Suicide bombers. The mission had been assigned to the Hamas command center in Ramallah, which operated a cell already in contact with several potential suicide bombers from Beit Likya, a Palestinian village northwest of Jerusalem. A day before the Tzrifin attack, a suicide bomber was dispatched to a restaurant in Jerusalem, but he retreated at the last minute, overcome by fear. Another bomber recruited for the mission, Ihab Abu Salim, was the young man who blew himself up the next day at the Tzrifin hitchhiking post. Prime Minister Sharon received news of the attack while meeting in New Delhi with his Indian counterpart, Atal Bihari Vajpayee. In his absence, he authorized Foreign Minister Silvan Shalom to take the necessary response actions. Shalom convened an urgent meeting of the heads of the IDF and the intelligence community at the Ministry of Defense. At 10 p.m., 4 hours after the soldiers at Srifin were murdered, Shalom asked the Shin Bet Andaman representatives present at the meeting whom in Hamas they could kill immediately. A suicide attack would not go unanswered. "We have quite good surveillance on Mahmoud al-Zahar," a Shin Bet official said. Al-Zahar was a surgeon, but also one of the founders of Hamas, and he was seen as the leader of the extreme faction in the organization. "Maybe we could take him out, but it would have implications as far as hurting uninvolved persons is concerned." An hour passed. Part of the discussion also revolved around the question of what to do with Yasser Arafat. Silvan Shalom had long been calling for Arafat to be killed or at least expelled. "He orchestrates terror, he stands behind attacks, and as long as he's around, there's no chance of stopping the bloodbath and reaching an accord with the Palestinians." Shalom said that a very senior official in the U.S. administration had telephoned to him after hearing about the attack and asked, "Do you intend to assassinate the bastard?" Opinions on how to handle Arafat were divided. In any case, it was clear that this was a major decision that only the prime minister could make. At 11:20 p.m., aides came into the room. Their faces were grave. Another suicide bomber had attacked, this time in Café Hillel, in Jerusalem's German colony. 7 people were dead, 57 wounded. The casualties included Dr. David Applebaum, the director of the emergency unit at Sha'ar Zedek Medical Center, and his daughter, Nava, who was to be married the next day. Al-Zahar was a dead man. Shalom used the satellite phone to call Yoav Galant, the former commander of Flotilla 13, who had participated in many targeted killing operations and was now serving as the prime minister's military secretary. Galant woke up Sharon, India is 2.5 hours ahead of Israel, who immediately approved a missile strike on Al-Zahar's home, but only after 8:30 the next morning, once the adults had gone to work, the school children were in class, and the streets were quiet. And what about Al-Zahar's family? In the atmosphere following 2 gruesome attacks in 6 hours that had horrified Israel, no one really paid much attention to this question. In the morning, Turban's sensors detected Al-Zahar making a call from his home, using the line in his office on the second floor. The JWR notified Shalom. Seconds later, another report came in from Turban. The call was an interview Al-Zahar was giving to the BBC Arabic service. Shalom was worried about the impact of a hit during a live broadcast. God forbid the boom would be heard, and ordered it postponed until the interview was over. The JWR personnel listened in until they heard Al-Zahar hang up. Since it was a landline phone with a single outlet, and since Al-Zahar's voice was clearly identified by Turban's skilled listeners and by the BBC interviewer, Al-Zahar's death warrant was approved. Even though no Shin Bet agent or camera had actually seen Al-Zahar in his office. 2 Apaches fired a total of 3 missiles, demolishing the house, killing Al-Zahar's son Khaled, 29 years old, and a bodyguard, and badly injuring his wife. But Al-Zahar was only scratched. He'd been out in the garden with a cup of coffee, a cigarette, and a cordless phone. Operation Picking Anemones wasn't working nearly as well in practice as it had in theory. Israel had missed several important targets, while Hamas had retaliated with 2 suicide bombers, 16 dead, and 75 wounded. And although various anti-terror measures adopted by Israel, including the targeted killings of Hamas operatives, had led to some decrease in the number of Israelis killed and injured, Operation Picking Anemones wasn't having the desired effect on the number of terror attempts. Hamas political figures might have been spooked, but the organization did not run out of people willing to become a shahid. The debate in the defense establishment intensified. What should be done about Sheikh Yassin?